Welcome. Welcome to everyone listening all around the world. That's right. All across the United States. We're coming to you live from the Faster Than Light headquarters, which tonight is the Coast to Coast AM studios right here in Los Angeles, California. Standing in on this Sunday evening and heading into Monday morning, I am your host, Jimmy Church. And tonight, my guest is Isaac Arthur. You see, here's the thing. I know that sometimes I like to have fun. I like to talk music and food, whatever. And I like to laugh. I like to laugh a lot. But it's all a part of who I am. And when I'm hosting Coast or my other shows, TV, live events, none of that stuff really matters. But what you get is the real me. Okay? I never phone it in. I don't try to be someone that I am not. Nope, not going to do it. I just don't. But the one thing that I do take very serious is research. Okay, I can clown. I like to have fun. And this conspiracy, UFO, universe, physics thing that we do, that I do, sometimes is taken really, really serious. And if I joke, you know, people will come at me and go, hey, man, you know, we can't jokes about that. What? Well, anyway, it's just me. But I take my research very serious. Every waking minute of my day is spent reading, watching, and learning. And I did this way before I was ever behind the microphone. It's who I am. So, it's like this. I'm going to let you in on a little secret. One of my go-to people is Isaac Arthur. I am constantly trying to get answers for faster than light travel, communications, the size and expansion of the universe, propulsion systems, types of interstellar craft, alien civilizations, physics, right? How one day we will travel to the stars. I want this info. And then one day, I found Isaac. Finally, someone much smarter than me researching the same stuff and presenting it in a way that I could understand. Isaac and his team put it all together. They do it with amazing graphics and music and math and materials and structures and full-on research in a way that we can all digest. So, I already know what's going on right now inside of your head. I know that after the show tonight, you're going to go out, you're going to check out his work. You're going to do that, and you should. But that's not what's most important. What is important is that you'll be saying these words. Quote me right now. This is what you're going to say to yourself. Where's this guy been, man? How come I'm just now finding out about Isaac Arthur? Well, you know what? That doesn't really matter. Because the really most important thing, the mostest important thing of all, is now that you know where I get my material from. Ba-dum-bump. And that's okay. Isaac knows. I've already admitted it to him. And in the future, when you hear me spouting facts and ideas and cool theories, you're going to go, well, you know, that's good. That's cool. But Church got that from Arthur. That's right. So turn down the lights. Get ready. This is a very special presentation. It's another event right here on Coast to Coast AM. You can follow me right now on Twitter at JChurchRadio. You already know I have Twitter live to my left. Follow me at JChurchRadio. You have to remember, the quickest and easiest way to get to me is on Twitter. I'm a social media guy. So hit me up over there on Twitter at JChurchRadio. Again, enjoy the bumper music tonight. Some very, very cool stuff. After last night where we did the rock and roll all night, I kind of I went the other direction. My other favorites, my other hits from another mindset. And later on, we're going to open up the phones because it's Sunday night. It's Coast to Coast AM. We've got Isaac Arthur here, and you are going to want to ask those questions. Let's do this. I'm your host, Jimmy Church, and I'll be right back with my guest, Isaac Arthur. This is Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. I'm your host, Jimmy Church, standing in on the Sunday night, heading into Monday morning. And I'll just give you guys a quick vibe. Here in Los Angeles, we're freaking out. It's still raining. It hasn't stopped for what seems like a few weeks now every day. And it's really cold and it's really windy. And I'm in here in this nice warm studio in the dock, hanging out with all of you. And tonight, my guest is Isaac Arthur, and I'm very excited about this. And when we do presentations like this on Coast to Coast, where we have a guest like Isaac, where we can just kick back like we have done and depended on with Coast to Coast over the years, where we can just sit and learn and just go down those subjects that we need to do. And we're going to do all of that tonight with Isaac. He's the host of Science and Futurism with Isaac Arthur, which is on YouTube. It's an amazing channel, over 300,000 subscribers, nearly 200 episodes right now covering topics like colonizing the solar system, interstellar travel, the Fermi paradox, artificial intelligence, and other topics representing possible future paths and challenges for humanity. He received his degree in physics from Kent State University, graduating top of his class at the age of 20. Remained there for graduate studies before joining the Army and serving in Iraq. He also worked as a civilian researcher at the Air Force Institute of Technology in Dayton, Ohio. Yeah, now don't you have questions for Isaac? His website is isaacarthur.net, and I would like to welcome, for the first time to Coast, Isaac Arthur, the source of my material. Isaac, good evening. How are you, man?
Doing great, Jimmy. Thanks for having me on.
It's so good to hear your voice, Isaac, and introducing you to the Coast audience for me is a very distinct honor, and I want to thank you for taking the time. We're going to go pole to pole tonight with you, but there's an obvious question here. Before I get to the Air Force Institute of Technology in Dayton, Ohio, right? That's a very interesting job. But before we get to that, for you, physics, the interest in science and your education, what brought you into these subjects and into our community? Why the fascination with what is going on in the universe?
Oh, well, I guess you could say I was born and raised for it. My middle name is Albert. So when your parents name you Isaac Albert, although there's probably indication they want you to go into physics. I kind of grew up on science fiction and science, so it's been a lifelong hobby for me, and certainly it's been a wonderful thing to do as an adult too. So,
and the idea for the program, I should say program, because it's an educational series that you have been doing over the last few years. The idea for that, was that a germ in a petri dish that was just, you know, fermenting for a while? Did you have an idea to do this?
You know, it really came out of nowhere for me. I was doing it as a quick hobby. I was helping out some folks on a world-building site for science fiction writers, and I'd gotten tired of repeating the same material over and over again. So I said, well, let's go ahead and slap together as a quick video. And, you know, sometime later, I got an email from YouTube saying, you have a subscriber. And I asked, what is a subscriber?
Wow.
And 4 years later...
And, you know, because I, as you know, I picked up on you very early on, and I shot you an email a few years ago now, reaching out to you, and I was so impressed with everything. But what I didn't start to put together was something that you suggested to everybody, and it caught me by surprise. It's something I've been repeating since then. Our community, Isaac, the Coast to Coast community, ufology, you know, this circle that we have, it's pretty big, but it's small compared to the rest of the planet. You and your circle, which is science fiction, the film industry, the writing industry, all of that, much bigger than our community. Do you think that your side of things, are they aware of Coast to Coast?
I would think so. I've been listening to Coast to Coast for years, and I'm certainly not alone in that. I almost thought, well, there's a lot of insomniacs in the science and sci-fi community, so I should rather imagine a lot of them here for the show. But, yeah, there's a lot of overlap. I mean, how can you know, science fiction is full of ufology and other things along those lines, and there's a lot of crossover, so there's certainly a lot of people have an interest in it.
Well, and see, with your research, everybody's going to go, the Coast audience is going to go and start checking you out after the show tonight. And I'm so excited for them to get exposed to your material.
You're
But
very welcome to come over.
yeah, they're going to love it. But this is what is really important, especially for me, is this. We have our ideas and our theories. We have our researchers. We have the authors that, I've interviewed over 1,000 researchers and authors over the years. That's a lot of information for me to go out there and collect. Your stuff is outside of the box from a scientific perspective, one that we don't hear much about inside of our community. And that's what I find really, really exciting. You guys are all very aware of ET and civilizations and colonizing the stars and figuring out faster than light and interstellar travel, but it comes from a different mindset than what we do here in the UFO community. And getting this crossover to happen tonight, I'm very excited about.
I'd be looking forward to it, so.
The ideas presented, did you start with the Fermi paradox?
No, we actually started with megastructures. We had noticed in, because we always like to use science fiction as one of our teaching tools for science, because it's whatever gets people interested, right? And we noticed on a lot of sci-fi, they have these planets, everything's always on planets, and it's usually a really simple one-dimensional planet. It's frozen oval. It's very jungly. And we said, that's probably not the actual future we'd be looking at much, though, because it's almost as easy to build a giant space station with an artificial environment that's much more Earth-like than it is to terraform a planet. And that's one of the difficulties there is if you want to go settle a planet like Mars, you would probably be having an easier time to build what we have to call an O'Neill cylinder in orbit around Earth with material sourced from the moon, and just keep building more and more of those until you match the area of Mars. And while you're busy terraforming Mars, you could already have turned out planets worth of these O'Neill cylinders for the same effort and in less time to create. So we often think that those kind of things, what we call megastructures, are the sorts of things that probably are more of humanity's future, and also more the sort of things we should be looking out there when we're doing SETI and ETI, looking for them out there, is that it's not so much trying to find a planet or a radio signal from them. It's trying to find the kind of enormous constructs that such civilizations might build, as they get out there in space.
We're certainly seeing that now, those challenges with our own, with the ISS and, eventually getting to Mars, that the moon always comes into play as we factor in all of these things and getting the resources off of Earth up, whatever those materials are to build something. That's one thing, but it would be easier to tap into the moon to get it done. Am I understanding you?
In most cases, yes. And in some cases, it might actually be easier to get them off of asteroids even further out than Mars is than to
Right.
get them off of Earth. Though that does kind of depend on what technologies and energy supply you have. We always like to look as far ahead in the future as possible because it's not covered as much as, people cover stuff that's 10, 20 years out a lot more. So we like to focus on the stuff that's a couple of centuries out, which is more speculative, of course, but a little bit more fun.
Now, let's stay right here for a second. When we're talking about megastructures, we're talking about things like a Dyson sphere.
Well, we'd often say a Dyson sphere itself is not a megastructural because the Dyson sphere concept is really more of a cloud of small satellites, many, many trillions of small satellites. And so it's less of a structural, like a city is not really a structural, a skyscraper is. A Dyson sphere or Dyson swarm, as we often call them, would usually be composed of tons of megastructures. So in that regard, it's more like a city full of megastructures. But these things can go from relatively big, generally bigger than things we build on Earth, to bigger than solar systems in some of the more extreme things we look at.
Now, what you presented an idea that I want to go straight there. I've got so many questions on my mind right now. So anyway, in dealing with expanding off of a planet, and let's say Earth, that it would be easier to just build a little community, you know, out in space that would tap into the resources of the sun or, you know, here on Earth, and then interconnect those. You wouldn't build a giant structure out of the gate. You would start with, you would be building a series of thousands or millions of smaller little towns, right?
Oh, no, billions or trillions.
Yeah, billions and trillions, right. But you start with one.
And billions. Yeah, you start with one, and we've already started, of course. The four satellites we put out there, and in some ways our own planets, are the beginning of a Dyson swarm, we'd say.
Right.
Dyson sphere originally meant the Dyson swarm, but it got this image in science fiction of being this rigid shell that you have to build all at once. Whereas what you'd instead probably do is just build lots and lots of smaller objects that you could link together physically in many cases, but by and large would just orbit in a cohesive pattern. It's a big like a fog around a about a star.
And how quickly could this be done? I mean, once, are we talking 100 years, 1,000 years, or is it, you know, you're just replicating?
Oh, sure. How quickly can you colonize a continent? You know, people say this is such a huge thing, they say, well, if you look at the United States and our huge freeway systems and our freight rail and all of the skyscrapers and cities,
right?
And if you went back to Jamestown or Plymouth Rock and said, wow, how could those guys possibly build all that in a mere 300-400 years? You know, how quickly does a population grow? How quickly do they want to expand? And of course, what technologies do they have to make it easier? The easier it is, the faster you can build. The faster you're increasing your numbers, the faster you need to build. What's nice about this kind of approach is it is incremental. You just add as you need to go. When you need a little bit more space, you build another one and add to the swarm. And in theory, at our current population growth, about 1% per year, you could fill one of these up in about 4,000 years, at which point it would have a billion times the living area that Earth has, and about a billion times the population as well.
You did some numbers presenting the population on Earth that stopped me dead in my tracks. Today, where today we're at, you know, 7 billion. But if we continue on the curve, we doubled in the last what years?
I think we quadrupled in the 20th century. I'd have to double check. I know in 1960, the United States had about half the population has right now.
Right.
I do not know how the world population, when it actually doubled currently. So it's 7.6 now. So whenever it was at around 3-4 billion, I think that would have been sometime after World War II. It doesn't take long.
It doesn't take long at all. So at our current rate, Isaac, where are we going to be in 10 years?
I think in 10 years, we'll probably only have added about another 100 million or so people to the planet. But that just depends on, you know, population is controlled by technology and culture. What can you support and what do you feel like having? In the future, people might not have as many kids as they have now, but they also might live a lot longer. And if you live in centuries of time by improved medical technology, you might have 10 or 20 kids, in which case you got quite a population explosion. You need to put them somewhere. Or we might see that we kind of slow down. We just say over a long period of time, over astronomical times, you will eventually fill one of these Dyson swarms up, and then probably more in the neighboring solar systems. But that might take a few thousand years. It might take a few million. It just depends on how fast the civilization grows.
Is there any way that we would stay on Earth? I mean, eventually we have to go.
I hope so. I mean, we don't have to. There are scenarios where you could keep this planet going, not just for millions of years to come, or even 4 billion. The sun would normally expand and die. But there are actually ways that you could, with inside the known physics, extend the lifetime of the sun or protect the Earth from, you know, the sun's nominal death when it goes into red giant phase. So you don't have to leave a planet. You know, you could protect yourself from asteroids and things like that, but you always have that keeping all your eggs in one basket problem. And, of course, then you've got the bigger one is you expect any species that gets self-technology is going to be curious, explorers, and expansionists. They're going to want to get out there and see what the rest of the galaxy is like. So I would hope that we would not just stay on Earth.
And you can see that I'm setting you up for where we are going next when we come back off of the break, which is if this is our attitude here and these are the issues that we are dealing with, certainly, if there's intelligent life out there in the Milky Way or in the universe, they're going through the same issues that we are, and they eventually have to leave their planet. This is Coast to Coast AM. Our guest tonight is Isaac Arthur. I'm your host, Jimmy Church, standing in on this Sunday, heading into Monday morning. This is Coast to Coast AM. Stay with us. All right, welcome back. Follow me on Twitter, at JChurchRadio. That's how I connect with all of you. You can hit me direct right there, 24-7. That's my social media world right there, Twitter. And I just posted this on Twitter right before the show tonight here on Coast. Breaking news. The Roswell Daily Record, the paper that originally broke the Roswell crash story, is now reporting that the ranch where the event occurred back in 1947 in July has been sold. It's been sold to a cattle ranching company as of November 27th, 2018. Now, during last year's Roswell Festival, which I have been to, the owners allowed the public to visit the site for the first time since 1947, and it's about 75 northwest of Roswell, New Mexico. The question is now, what happens to the Mac Brazel Ranch? What is going to go down? What is the future? Absolutely stunning breaking news. Isaac Arthur is my guest tonight. We're going to cover it all. We're going to do the Fermi Paradox. We're going to do interstellar warfare, dark energy, the Kardashev scale, force fields, faster than light, generation ships, Dyson spheres, colonizing space, and I might even dabble in a little android stuff. We'll see how it goes. Isaac Arthur is my guest. I'm your host, Jimmy Church. This is Coast to Coast AM. Stay with us. Welcome back to Coast AM. Our guest tonight, Isaac Arthur. And we are discussing Arthur's research that he has got in his video series over at Science and Futurism. And the links for everything Isaac Arthur are over at Coast to Coast AM. And you need to go and check it out. It's nothing like taking notes and getting your learn on. Isaac, we were discussing right before the break the need to leave the planet, megastructures and Dyson spheres, all kind of interconnected, certainly in your world too. And if we decided not to leave the planet for whatever reason, population decreased, our resources were brought under control, and we just decided not to do that, is ET also in that same position, in that that's where maybe the Fermi paradox could come into play, where they just don't want to be bothered?
Oh, sure. We often say that's, we don't know what the answer to the Fermi paradox is, of course, yet. And we often have these filters that might be what causes them to be less common. And one of the ones that gets suggested is that we have many filters behind us, but we still have some in front. And one of those might be that it just turns out that interstellar space travel is just not something that is possible or practical until we actually have, you know, some working colonies out there of our own among the stars. We really can't say for sure. It might turn out that it's quite possible, but we just don't really want to do it, too. Just because you can colonize Antarctica doesn't mean that you do, although I think that we probably will at some point. So lots of exploration we've done, and we've never backed away from challenges, so I think that we would. And I would tend to think any species that had developed a lot of technology would, too.
And then the breaking news last year, which I covered, sort of, you know, it's still in the news, is Tabby Star, KIC 846-2852. I've got it memorized, right? That got to be pretty exciting, and I don't think the story has quite died yet. We haven't really solved it, but it certainly strongly suggested a megastructure, and that's what the news was reporting it as, the possibility of an alien megastructure. What did you think when the news first broke?
Well, I remember when I first heard it, and I always tend to look at these things and say, especially from our standpoint discussing megastructures, if this was a megastructure, what sort of megastructure could it be? And none of the ones we normally would discuss really fit the marker too well, which doesn't really mean too much. You go back and ask engineers in Rome what a skyscraper is from a distance, they probably aren't going to guess. So we don't know, you know, what format they might be building towards, but it didn't fit any of the ones we would normally say. And there have been quite a few suggestions for what it might be from a natural standpoint, but it's just one of those examples of things that, you know, we really need to get a better look at. And the next generation of telescopes will hopefully tell us a lot more about objects like that when we find these anomalies. But we are constantly finding these kind of anomalies, and, you know, we learn something a little bit new and different about each one. But Tavistar is, you know, whether it's a natural source or something more artificial, and I tend to tilt toward the former, it's going to tell us a lot more about the universe around us.
Years ago, not terribly long ago, but 15 years ago, we had an exoplanet count of one. Right. Of one.
You only found one.
Yeah, right.
It's like 8,000, 6,000.
Yeah, right. Yeah, today it's over 4,000 officially logged and another 9,000 that are discovered but haven't been given catalogs yet. But that's, you know, that's where we're at today. And now, in the last few years, certainly since you've started your presentations, now the general understanding of our Milky Way is that we don't have 10 planets out there, we don't have 20, but that we have 100 billion. 100 billion planets in our Milky Way. Now it's an exciting time to be an astrophysicist.
Absolutely. Well, it's been an exciting time since we invented the telescope, but these are great times because we get to see so much more since we get to pick really big telescopes. 100 billion planets is probably an underestimate. That might be how many are around stars that are reasonably enough like our own and close enough to their own sun that they'd be warm enough to have life. But there's, you know, probably going to be planets around almost every star. And I would not be surprised if we've cataloged trillions of planets just in the Earth and larger zones. And then, of course, you have all those dwarf planets, too. We'll probably find another 100 or so of those in our own solar system of the smaller Neptunoids and Plutonoids.
Sure. And the interview that I saw was a couple of weeks ago with an astronomer. He literally said, if you want to go and find your own exoplanet, all you have to do is go to work for one night. And you'll find one. That's pretty nutty. This wasn't even a concept 20 years ago.
No. And it is just amazing how much easier it's gotten to do. Though, of course, when they say that, you do need some decent hardware to do that. But you can, you know, we are finding, I have up to, 15,000 if you include the candidates, then we'd be finding one almost every day. So
that's right. Amazing. Yeah, it's extraordinary. Now, to populate, now let's go back to where we set this up with. To populate the Milky Way, to go out and discover and to expand and to grow, you have to increase your population, you have to find those resources. But eventually, it's going to happen, whether it's by us or by different civilizations that are out there. There could be millions of civilizations, we don't know, or there could be one or two. But if it started, how rapidly would our Milky Way get overtaken?
Probably in about a million years tops. If you're limited to light speed and probably only a fraction of light speed at that point, say 10% of light speed, you can still colonize an entire galaxy. And, you know, a million years sounds like a lot of time to us and certainly isn't a short time. But compared to the age of the galaxy, it's about a second in the course of a day. So it takes very little time to colonize a galaxy, assuming you have the right technology and expansion for it.
And we would also have to be, to see something like this, Isaac, we would have to be at the right place at the right time, in that we have only been observing our Milky Way as it is right now, I guess, since Edwin Hubble, I guess, if we go back, you know, 1923, 1925. So in a very, very short window, we would have to be at the right place at the right time to see this occupation happen.
Mm-hmm. Well, you'd have to be there while it was going on. But of course, if it had always taken place, it's sort of like, 70, 80,000 years ago. I can't remember what that asteroid event was they hypothesized, but they said there were only maybe a few hundred humans left. Don't quote me on that number. And yet now the whole planet is full. If you look around now for people, it's very easy to find them. But in those early days, it would be very hard to find. So if somebody had gotten a head start on us, you know, we wouldn't have any problems finding them in that kind of context. So it does depend on, you know, who showed up first, how fast they're expanding, and how many such civilizations exist. Is it just a few? Is it, you know, many per galaxy? Is it only one per supercluster? You know, we just don't know yet in terms of the distribution.
With a SETI, because we have to know what to look for. And mm-hmm. is SETI doing the right thing? I mean, what do we need to see? What is it that we need to look for when we're looking for this expansion of the universe into the Milky Way?
I wouldn't say it's really a right thing or a wrong thing. What SETI aims to do is what it can. And, you know, you look for the lowest hanging fruit first, which is to look for those radio signals. But, you know, they're realists about this. We don't know that anybody would necessarily be using radio signals or omnidirectional radio signals like we're on right now. They might be using something that was point-to-point like a laser. You know, they're looking for what they can. There's a second half of that kind of research, which is just looking for, you know, things like Dyson spheres or very large megastructures or K3 civilizations, which is a galaxy-spanning one. And it's not that we necessarily are going to be able to find those. It's that we have a method to look for them that way. And that's, of course, so you look for what you can have a decent chance of finding. It may not be the best way to look, but it's the one that's available.
And if we are out looking at, you know, with Hubble, and we're starting to see galaxies disappear, right? Because that's one of the things that we would see if Dyson spheres are being built around stars and blocking out the stars and they take over a galaxy, then that means the light from the galaxy would not be reaching us. And technically, the galaxy would start to disappear because it's being overtaken.
Mm-hmm. Yes and no. For a classic Dyson swarm, you're just transferring the visible light into infrared waste heat. So you would be able to see that, and we'd be scanning for that. That, of course, assumes they're using the same thermodynamics we are, which I think are pretty solid, a lot of thermodynamics, but we have only had them for 2 centuries, so somebody might find a workaround one day. In that kind of case, you're going to see the galaxy kind of slowly disappear. And if those are the kind of civilizations that come into existence, the ones that just swarm out around the stars and build massive collectors and habitats around each one, then you'd actually be able to see these things disappear. And if they were in your own galaxy, you'd be wondering not who's living around those stars, but what a star was, because you'd never seen one until you had radio telescopes and infrared telescopes, because the night sky would be black.
Right. Right. And the other part of this is our sun is extremely stable. Okay, we've had a pretty good run. We've had a pretty good run with our sun, and it's not the case even in our own Milky Way, where you've got a sun that hasn't radically changed in 4, 5, 10 billion years, because that's what it takes to develop life.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. And now every star changes with time. Every one of them starts to warm up over time. You know, we always talk about how the sun will one day expand into being a red giant, but it actually gets a little bit warmer each year. It goes up in brightness by about 1% per 100 million years. I would have to check that.
Mm-hmm.
It just gets a little bit warmer with time. And there actually is a bit of a paradox for us as we are wondering why the Earth would be habitable 4 billion years ago, because it might have been a little bit too cold based on sunlight. But we look out at other stars and we see how old they are and how much light they're giving off based on their mass. And we say, well, these ones are younger, these ones are older, they're giving off more light. Our sun is remarkably stable, not freakishly so, but really quite stable. And we have no way of knowing how common habitable zone planets like our own are at this time. We don't know how often you're going to get an Earth-like planet in one of those zones. We don't know how many of those stars are stable enough and what level of stability we need. And we actually don't know that you really need a very Earth-like planet around a very sun-like sun to host life. It might turn out to be much easier than we think it is. Or it might turn out that we are radically underestimating how easy it is for life to evolve, too.
Why is it that our universe, and when I say our universe, I firmly believe there are infinite universes out there. We are just, this is ours. But our universe, with the Big Bang, the way that it happened here, we have life. Things are created here, right? Stars, planets, things, elements, gases, photons, electrons, everything. It's just perfect. Gravity was at the right spot at the right time, the right numbers, where we have life in this universe. But if it was just a fraction off, if one of those numbers were off, we could be a universe full of just lifeless dust, right?
Oh, definitely. This is what we call the fine-tuning concept in general. And to be fair, we don't really know exactly how broad that range is, or that there might not be other islands of stability where you might get something akin to chemistry going on for different laws. You know, change the speed of light a little bit, change the strength of gravity a little bit, and things would not work as they are right now. And as best we can tell, in most cases, they wouldn't work at all. You just wouldn't get chemistry. But that's hard to say right now. And of course, when you look at that, when you look at those odds, and it's staggeringly based on what numbers people produce for that for basic models, the odds are so huge that you have to look at it and say, well, we could just be the example where we won the lottery because there's a vast number, an absurd number of universes, and this just happens to be one that got life in it. Or maybe this is the only universe and we just really lucked out. Or possibly it's a cyclic type of thing where the universe just keeps popping up, expanding, contracting, or dying and getting replaced until eventually you get one that walks with life. Or, of course, the other options are, you know, potentially that was engineered, which certainly has many variations like, well, simulation hypothesis or various theological options. And we don't obviously have any way of knowing yet. We don't even have a basic testable hypothesis for how we'd find out.
Well, when we run the numbers, like the numbers of us having to take a break here in 60 seconds, when we run the numbers, Isaac, numbers are numbers. That's it. And the odds are the numbers say possibilities are endless. Anything is possible. And right now, there is another planet out there identical to this one where there's a graduate in physics host talking to a radio host without that never left elementary school, talking about the universe and the possibility of life out there. And their names are Isaac and Jimmy. And that is really the only way to look at it.
Oh, well, there are some lots of additional fascinating options on top of that, though. I know we're going to have to go to break before we have a chance to discuss them. So,
Yeah, and we're going to do that when we come back. Also, Isaac, the two things right now that are going around in physics, I think that are discussed the most are dark energy and faster than light. And I want to discuss both of those in depth when we come back after the break. Our guest tonight is Isaac Arthur. He's the host of Science and Futurism, and that is over on YouTube. The links are at Coast to Coast AM. I am your host, Jimmy Church. I'll be right back after this short break. Stay with us.